first case this morning, 95-2912 Sierra State v. Jason Phillips, representing the state as Paul Lunston, Assistant Attorney General. Good morning.
Chief Justice, members of the court. This is a Fourth Amendment search and seizure case. The defendant sought and was denied suppression of evidence. There is conflicting testimony below. I'll address that, and I'd be very glad to address it. It seems to be a main topic for the defendant. But what I'm going to start with is the evidence viewed most favorably to the trial judge's decision, which is, I think, the way this court should view the evidence. On a day in September in 1994, the police had information from a confidential informant that Jason Phillips was dealing in small quantities of marijuana, and they went to his house to investigate. They understood that he had a bedroom in the basement of his parents' house. Three officers went to the house. From a distance, they saw Mr. Phillips, and as they approached, they saw him walk down into an exterior stairwell to the basement. The record's pretty clear on what kind of situation we're talking about here. This is apparently a situation where you have doors that open up on the top, exterior doors that are stairs that go into the ground, and then at the bottom of the steps, there's an upright door. When the police got to the stairwell, both doors were open. From the top of the stairs, one of the officers called, "Hey, Jason." Mr. Phillips, who was down in the basement, responded, said, "Yeah." The officers then proceeded down the steps. The lead officer produced his badge, announced that they were drug agents, and they proceeded down the steps. Unfortunately, when they got to the bottom of the steps, to the open doorway, they didn't stop. They passed through that open doorway, and there's agreement that when they did that, they committed an illegal entry into the basement. Inside the basement, they had a discussion. They asked Jason his name. He gave his name. Jason asked the officers why they were there, and they told him. They told him that they had information. He had marijuana. They were there to investigate, and that if they found the marijuana, they were there to take it. It's clear in the record that the officers asked them for permission to enter Jason's bedroom. And I should say that in the course of the conversation, Jason admitted that he did have marijuana and he had it in his bedroom. They asked for permission. There's some conflict in the testimony about how he gave consent, but as I'll flesh out a little later, it's clear that he did give consent either by simply saying yes verbally or by walking over to his bedroom door, which was adjacent to this room that they were in, opening the door and leading the officers in. So whether it was nonverbal or verbal, he gave consent. Inside, not much happened. They located the marijuana. According to the officers, Mr. Phillips was cooperative throughout this process and, in fact, helped produce the marijuana in his bedroom. Apparently, his bedroom was small. One of the officers, the lead officer, took Mr. Phillips back out of that, back into this more common first room, common area, and talked to Mr. Phillips some more. So those are the facts that we have. There's three topics I'd like to talk about this morning. The first is, apart from the facts in this case, what's the standard of review that should be applied to the topic of voluntariness of consent? Second, something kind of peculiar to this case, not so peculiar, that's why I think it's important, but something that doesn't happen that often, and that's the problem of the Court of Appeals in their decision engaging in basic fact-finding. I think they gave lip service to giving deference to the trial judge's fact-finding, but then they turned around and found facts on their own in conflict with the trial judge. And third is the media issue here dealing with the voluntariness of consent and the effect of the illegal entry, and that would be the attenuation analysis.
Counsel, is voluntariness of consent a constitutional fact?
Well, that is what I am asserting it is. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it is.
Recently, we have the case of State versus McMorris. I think I have the slip opinion, October 30th, 1997, which cites to State versus Anderson. In State versus Anderson, McMorris states, this court characterized as a constitutional fact the question whether evidence should be suppressed as the fruit of illegal search or whether the evidence was sufficiently attenuated so as to be purged of the taint. McMorris goes on to indicate that in a constitutional fact, we have both deference due to the historical fact, but application of the constitutional principles requires no deference, that it's a dual approach. Do you concede that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me to concede.
Well, it seems to me your argument says that is that although it's a constitutional fact, that deference should it be given to the finding of the trial court as to the issue of voluntariness of the consent. Yet we just have McMorris, which arguably can be interpreted differently, and October 23rd, 1997, Gerald Van Camp, State of Wisconsin, which says the same thing. That is, we review constitutional questions independent of the conclusion of the lower courts. We will not accept the circuit court's finding of evidentiary or historical facts unless they are clearly erroneous. But we, it goes on to say, but we apply, of course, the constitutional principles. So within the last 2 months, it seems to me, or 3 months, in late October, we have two cases from this Supreme Court that argue contrary to your position. How do you address those two cases?
Well, I wish it were the case that there was consistency among the various constitutional topics about how the standard review works. And as an appellate attorney, I would love nothing better than for it always to be the same if you have a constitutional question.
Have you had an opportunity to review those cases? It seems to me, maybe my reading is incorrect, but it seems to me both are saying constitutional constitutional facts have a dual approach. That is, we give deference to the historical findings of the trial court and to the constitutional principles. There is no deference. Both of these cases within the last 3 months of this court say that. You're asking that we change that.
I'm not. I haven't read those two cases. I gather neither of them specifically address the standard review of the voluntariness of consent. If they do, then I've missed it.
No, that's why my threshold question to you is whether or not you concede this is a constitutional fact, because both do specifically say constitutional facts have that dual approach.
If my answer is no, I don't think this is properly characterized as a constitutional fact. If by that you mean it leads automatically to the mixed question approach.
Understand your position then. Your position now is that the voluntariness of consent is not a constitutional fact. Is that what you're saying?
I don't want to get caught up in the semantics of it, because in my research over the years, I think that the courts have been inconsistent about how they treat these questions.
What do you suggest should be the standard of review of voluntariness?
I think that that this court, particularly in standards of review and in large, and generally in matters of Fourth Amendment law, this court has conformed its law with the United States Supreme Court law. I don't see any reason to deviate from that practice in this particular case. The United States Supreme Court has very clearly called this a fact question that we accord deference to, that we give deference to the trial judge's determination on. This court addressed the topic, this very same topic, in Turner. And in that case, what the court did, as it frequently does, is it looked to the United States Supreme Court law. unfortunately, it looked to the wrong case. It looked to Miller v. Fenton, which is the voluntariness of confessions. Instead, it should have looked to Schnickloff, which addresses the topic in this case, voluntariness of consent. Schnickloff, as I said, clearly says that this is a fact question. I think that was just an oversight. I think that if, from reading this court's Turner decision, it would appear to me that if the writer of that decision had been aware of Schnickloff, he would have come down with the same standard as the United States Supreme Court, because you appeared to be wanting to conform your standard review with that of the United States Supreme Court.
Why did the U.S. Supreme Court have two different rules for what looked like the same kind of issue?
And again, I, as an appellate attorney, I really would love to have consistency. I don't know that there's a principled reason for having a different standard review for voluntariness of confession and voluntary consent.
That was my question. It seems to me that although many cases may not present different answers or different questions, you could clearly have an instance where there was a confession that was voluntary, or you could have a case in which a confession was made in which it was not voluntary. So don't most of these cases really present two questions? I start off by saying I don't think they do, but in other words, the first question being, was there consent as a matter of historical fact, or was there a confession as a matter of historical fact? And then the next question that must always be asked is, as a matter of constitutional law, was it voluntary?
That's exactly right. I think there's no dispute on the first question about whether indeed you give consent, verbally giving it, or verbally give the confession, that's a fact question. There's no doubt about that. On the second question, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. On the second part of that.
The second part being the question of voluntariness under the Constitution, taking into account the totality of the circumstances. Was this, in fact, a freely and voluntarily given statement, or was it in some manner coerced? And it seems to me that doesn't that present some constitutional questions for which we should give no deference?
Well, in the sense that the Constitution requires that it be voluntary, it's clearly a constitutional question. But because, in my own view, Schnickloff got it right, that it's a factual question at its core, and Miller v. Fenton, dealing with the voluntariness of confession, got it wrong. I mean, if they had been looking at it logically, it seems to me that that is exactly the sort of determination that is, you know, that a judge has to sit there and look at these witnesses and say, you know, are they telling me the truth? The defendant in this case testified. He testified that he was coerced. He testified about...
Well, what about the situation, for instance, in a confession where outrageous pictures are shown to a defendant, and thereafter follows a confession? A trial judge may well find that... We don't differ as to the fact that the pictures were shown, but this court may well differ with the interpretation to be given or what result necessarily follows. A trial court may well find that the showing of these outrageous pictures did not constitute involuntariness, and yet this court may say, hey, as a matter of constitutional law, that is involuntary.
I suspect you and I agree.
I think we do.
That there are going to be situations where the facts are clear. You're in just as good a position as a trial judge to make a judgment call about whether there was coercion or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't disagree with that basic premise. My feeling is that generally, more often, there are going to be a lot of subtleties involved.
A lot of what?
A lot of subtleties involved about the defendant's, you know, his characteristics, how sharp he is, how intelligent he is, things that the trial judge is in a better position to assess in terms of saying, well, what would a reasonable person in the defendant's position, you know, having his characteristics of intelligence, experience, how would he perceive these things? It's my own view that more often there are going to be factors involved that the trial judge is in the best position to judge, and that's why you should give deference.
Mr. Lundstein, if you and Justice Babich basically agree, then what did the Court of Appeals do wrong here? You said they engaged in improper fact-finding. What did they do?
Well, apart from the constitutional question that we were just talking about, when they were coming to their decision about what happened in this case, you know, they're discussing why Mr. Phillips, why the search was improper, they would rely on facts that are contrary to what the judge found. For example, at one point in the Court of Appeals decision, it expressly states that the police did not seek his permission to enter the bedroom. It's clearly contrary to what the judge found to be true.
So in other words, your argument would be with their determinations, if you will, in regard to historical facts?
Yes. Also, their determination, well, kind of up and down the line, the historical facts, what I was talking about earlier, and I think what you were asking about just now, but also they rejected my my pitch on the standard of review that we've just been talking about here. And then I also have a disagreement with how they approach the attenuation analysis, because they never looked at whether or not Mr. Phillips gave voluntary consent. They never separately looked at the facts and said, you know, would a, from his perspective, did he give voluntary consent? Just completely glossed over that topic. I think that was improper. I think that was a necessary component of addressing the entire case.
So what if you and I are in agreement then, and you recognize that there are those occasions in which this court is going to find that a historical fact as found by the judge, nevertheless, we differ with the judge as to how to interpret that, or how to apply the Constitution to that. So how do we write it then? What's the standard? Recognizing that there are those instances.
Well, because I think, as a matter of good jurisprudence, I think there's a lot to be said for being consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court. There's enough conflict for us to deal with, and confusion in the water to deal with already.
But do you really believe the Supreme Court really meant that they are never, that they would take a case, for instance, and if a judge, a federal trial judge found that showing of these pictures was okay, that they would say, well, we'll defer to that finding? They wouldn't do that, really, would they, Mr. Lundstein? If they really felt, if five of them felt that was, in fact, coercion, and not voluntariness, they're not going to defer to that.
It's the beauty of being a justice. You're able to do that when you want to by just not talking about what you're doing. So that is always an option, no matter what you hold today. But seriously, I think that like I said earlier, I think that because it's difficult sitting as a judge to know what was really going on at the trial level, you know, you can make inferences that this was cut and dry by looking at the transcript. But I don't know, and it's not always true. In this case, I don't think that's true. This might be a very good example. If you read through the transcripts, I would be quick to admit that the police officers gave some conflicting testimony on various points. And apparently the Court of Appeals got the impression that there was something amiss with the officers here. But on the other hand, the trial judge, who heard the testimony, found Mr. Phillips to be a bald-faced liar, didn't rely on anything that he said. And the fact of the matter is, if you read the testimony very, very closely, there's very little conflict among the officers' testimony. So, because I think it's difficult to tell, sitting above, whether this is a cut-and-dried situation or whether there's something more subtle going on, I think the general rule, it would be better to have the general rule of deferring to the trial court. I can't reconcile the U.S. Supreme Court treating voluntariness of confessions differently. And Again, I wish that they were consistent.
You stated that the Court of Appeals, did they skip the issue of voluntary consent, or did they find different than the trial court of voluntary consent?
I think they skipped it.
They skipped it.
They say that it's a question in the case. They imply that they're going to address it. As you read the decision, I don't think you're able to tell what their opinion is on that topic. I mean, you can infer that if they had addressed it, they would have found it involuntary. But they don't. They don't address it. They don't talk about what it looked like from his perspective.
Counsel?
We could have those cases also where maybe these are the majority of cases when we differ, where we agree with the facts, or we agree with the fact finder and give them deference, but that the cumulative effect of these facts, we believe, dictate a different result under the Constitution than does the... And we would never defer to a trial court as to the constitutional implications. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think the voluntariness is sort of a unique animal among constitutional questions, in my view. And you may disagree, but I'm not sure how to answer that question. But one thing I see, my yellow light's on, and I don't know if the timing mechanism is wrong or could that possibly have been...
No, the questions have been many.
Yeah, because we start at 9:45, so we started a bit late.
Time.
So the mechanism may very well be right. Why don't you get to the other issues?
Time is flying. I wanted to hit on this more core question of voluntariness of Mr. Phillips' consent. Essentially, in this brief, I'm making a pitch that you look at voluntariness by itself. I think the Court of Appeals got it wrong because they looked at the illegality, they didn't like it, it was blatant, and they wanted to punish the police officers, and in an effort to do that, they sort of skipped over whether there was an attenuating factor. And in this case, I say it's the voluntariness of the consent. When the police pass through that open door, they committed an illegal act. But if you look at it from Mr. Phillips' perspective, I don't think he was much affected by it. I don't think a reasonable person would have been much affected by it. More importantly, I don't think the police officers hoped to gain anything by passing through that doorway. They could have stopped at the doorway, at the open doorway, had the same conversation with Mr. Phillips, confronted him with what they knew. The reason that he let them search the bedroom is, I think, because he thought the jig was up and he'd maybe be better off cooperating. So the police officers, if they'd had their thinking cap on, would have just stopped at that doorway, had the same conversation, achieved the same results. They didn't go through the doorway to search without consent. They didn't go through the doorway to seize without consent. They just wanted to talk to Mr. Phillips to obtain consent. There's testimony they went there to ask him for permission to search his bedroom. So clearly a violation, but I don't think it's a blatant violation in the sense that they busted down the door, and I don't think it's a blatant violation in the sense that they are violating or intending to violate the constitutional rights, the protections of the Fourth Amendment, protections against seizure without consent, search without consent. So that if you look at the voluntariness of consent, the lack of coercive factors, I think that you would arrive at the conclusion that Mr. Phillips gave voluntary consent. If you disagree with me on looking at that in isolation, the case is over. If they don't have voluntary consent into the bedroom, there's no justification. There's no real reason to engage in attenuation factors separately.
Counsel, so, do we have to overrule State versus Turner with regard to the issue of the standard of review?
Yes. I would suspect the author of Turner wouldn't mind so much, because I think he or she, I forgot which.
Justice Cecil, I think.
Simply looked at the wrong U.S. Supreme Court case when they addressed the standard of review. So that's...
Well, it almost sounds like you're arguing sort of a spin-off on the good faith exception.
I'm sorry?
It almost argues that, I'm hearing this like you're arguing for a spin-off or of a good faith exception to the that the officers were in good faith, sort of a no harm, no foul rule.
I didn't think of it that way. I suppose you could, but I'm certainly not relying on good faith or that sort of approach. It is sort of a no harm, no foul. There's harm, but there's always harm in attenuation cases. I mean, there's lots of cases out there. I cite lots of them in my brief where you begin with an initial police illegality. Usually it's more egregious. Usually it's a physical arrest, something that is more intrusive and more coercive to the defendant. But there's always an initial illegality. That doesn't mean that you then suppress everything that comes afterward. The question is whether there's an intervening factor. And in my mind, a pretty clear intervening factor in this case is the voluntariness of Mr. Phillips' consent. So that's why I'm asking the court to look with a clear eye at individually the voluntariness of Mr. Phillips' consent and try to determine that question and then put it in the context of the attenuation analysis and decide whether it's a sufficient attenuating factor.
Counsel, Chief, may I ask you some questions? Page 34 of your brief, you say the state also agrees there were no intervening circumstances. And yet I just heard you arguing now that the intervening circumstance is the voluntariness of the consent. This is page 34, the second paragraph from the bottom. The first sentence reads, the state also agrees there were no intervening circumstances.
Oh, well, that was an unfortunate choice of words. I repudiate that. I think I was meaning that there was no intervening circumstance in the sense that I just have to say I was wrong. I was thinking probably when I wrote that about something intervening between the time they entered the basement and the time they asked him for consent. And that was wrong-headed because the question here isn't those two points in time. The question is there something intervening between the time they entered the basement and the time that they seized the evidence? And I hope I'm clearly arguing, when you read my entire brief, that there is an intervening circumstance in that sequence of events, and it's the voluntariness of consent. So I just have to say that I was not careful when I wrote that paragraph.
Thank you, Mr. Lonson. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Nathan, you are representing the defendant, Phillips. Mr. Phillips.
Justice Abrahamson, members of the court. I'd like to start out by saying that in my years of practice, I have never had a judge render a decision in which he made a statement that I don't really understand this. This is not his best decision, and I may not be describing this very well. I'd also like to say that I agree with the Assistant Attorney General to the effect that attenuation was not a factor here. Attenuation is not a factor here because the police came down, and according to Agent Laundry, he and Agent Simmons immediately began to search. He doesn't talk about a permission being given. He says that he heard from Agent Zabluski that they had permission to enter. Agent Zabluski never said they had permission to enter. In fact, Agent Zabluski admits that they walked down in, and there were three of them, and the three of them just walked in, and the force of their walking in
isn't that conceded? I think the question is that after they were there, then they asked, you said, yeah, come on in. If I got the fact, that's the consent.
Well, Mr. Justice, the reason why I am bringing that up is it goes to the credibility of the officers. Where an officer says, I heard somebody tell me, that is, an agent Zabluski tells me, I have permission to enter. And Agent Zabluski never says he told anybody they had permission to enter. And when Laundry says, so after I heard this and I entered, Agent
Simons and myself began to search. Then you have Agent Simon saying, I heard Jason Phillips give Agent Zabluski permission to search. And Agent Zabluski never says, I heard Jason Phillips give me permission to search. Agent Zabluski is saying that Jason Phillips turned and entered the bedroom. And as the appellate court pointed out, based on the questions and answers that came afterwards, was that Agent Zabluski assumed that when Jason turned and entered the bedroom and he followed him in, that was consent. Now, so in terms of the question, was there consent, how can there be a credible finding of consent when you have three officers, all within close proximity of each other, giving three separate accounts of what went on? Now, one of the things which the state talks about is they. This is not a they. This is three individuals. You can't clump them together and say they collectively did this. No, they individually did three separate things. And it was those three separate things that they talked about which constitute an incredible finding that there was consent.
Well, counsel, let's move from the verbal portion of the consent issue to the visual portion of the consent issue. There is evidence in the record that the defendant got up, went to his bedroom, and that the officers followed him as he went to his bedroom, and that they assumed by his moving into the bedroom after the discussion that possession of drugs, paraphernalia, would be a violation of the law, that they assumed from that act consent. Is there disagreement in the record regarding that portion of the facts?
There is the statement of the officers, which is given a different position by the defendant. Now, what you have to consider is this, that if the officers admit that they walked down the stairs without any permission, is there any reason to believe that they entered the bedroom with permission? That they just followed him into the bedroom? Now, he could have been walking into that bedroom to get away from them, to shut the door, but they followed after him. So he has got three officers following him into the bedroom. That is the position that the officers have. In fact, that's not the position the officers have. The officers have different positions. The two officers supposedly are already searching the bedroom while Zabluski is talking to Jason. On the other hand, Simon says, no, I didn't start to search the bedroom until after I heard Jason give Zabluski permission. Now, it is such a bad lack of corroboration of any officer to the other. It's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. Usually these officers get together beforehand and figure out what they're going to say. And certainly there was enough time for the officers to do this because we had a preliminary hearing, and then we had the motion after the preliminary hearing, and then we had some more motions after the preliminary hearing.
Counsel, if they were going to collaborate, they would have, in a way that you suggest, it seems to me as if they would have all reached the same conclusion that Jason did, in fact, give oral consent.
Exactly.
But they did not say that. They said that, in fact, Officer Zabluski, I believe it was, said that he did not get oral consent.
That's correct. Officer Zabluski said he got no consent.
When an officer tells says on the record that they did not get oral consent, I tend to believe just about everything else they say, too, because they could make, if they were going to lie, they'd make their lie the actual consent.
But again, office assignment says they get actual consent. And officers LaBluse and Officer Laundry said he was told they had actual consent.
I don't read that even from the statement of your facts, Mr. Nathan.
You don't read that Simon says that he heard Jason give consent to Zabluski?
Simon says what?
Agent Simon, that he heard a conversation between Zabluski and Jason, and the result of that conversation was that the agents had permission to search. The subject may not have come up. The question, it seems to me, before us is whether or not the actions or other conversations, although they did not include an actual consent to search, whether or not it all of it taken together constituted a permission to search. You can give permission, I take it, without giving actual oral consent, can't you?
I think the question was on the cross-examination. I believe Simon said, I heard him give consent.
Well, I have not read that, sir, so you could be right. I just read your statement of facts, and I found it somewhat ambiguous.
Also, Laundry indicates that he came down into the room and they began the search contemporaneous with coming down into the room.
What did the trial court find as to consent?
I'm sorry?
Was there a trial court finding on consent?
The trial court found that there was consent.
Okay.
And the trial, I'm sorry.
And do you agree that the standard of review for at least that issue, namely whether there was consent is a factual issue, and that the trial court finding will be supported unless it's clearly erroneous?
I believe it has to be accepted unless it's clearly erroneous,
okay.
But it has to be looked at in terms of a constitutional standard.
Even under your statement of the facts, there seem to be sufficient facts to show consent. I mean, the judge could believe one officer and not another. So even if you have three officers saying three different things, the judge could believe Officer A that he got express consent, right?
Yes.
Okay. So for the moment, and I'm not fighting you, why don't we say that there's a finding of fact, there's a finding of consent, and that there is some evidence in the record that supports that, and move on to the question of voluntariness.
For the sake of argument, I will say what you're saying is true, although I don't necessarily concede it.
I agree with that. That's fine. I'm not asking him to concede it. I'm asking him to talk about voluntary because I think it may not be the rest of the bench's position that may be the more difficult issue.
Okay.
Counsel, as you approach the issue of voluntariness, are there any facts in the record that show lack of voluntariness, that is, coercion?
Well, I think that Jason's testimony was that he didn't volunteer consent. I think that the statement of Officer Laundry that they entered and began to search immediately indicates lack of voluntariness of consent.
Any other facts? One of the things I was thinking about was when he testified, if I recall correctly, that his mother was upstairs dying with cancer, and that they said that if they didn't let him search the bedroom, that they were going to search the whole house and disturb her. Did I get that fact wrong, or is that in that record?
No, that's what he said that the officers had said to him, but he denied that he gave them permission.
Could you focus a little bit on what you believe the voluntariness element requires? Because at least what I hear you saying is Jason said he didn't voluntarily give consent, meaning he didn't give consent. And I'd like you to accept the fact, as the chief has suggested for purposes of argument at this point, that there is consent. what is it we have to look at to determine whether that's a voluntary consent or not?
I think what you have to look at is the totality of the circumstances, in the sense of the confines of the room, the three officers being there, the entrance into that room being without consent and acknowledged being without consent, and therefore that's it's a constitutional violation.
So it's the shape and configuration of the room. What else? I know you're arguing that there wasn't consent, but I'm asking you to accept there was consent. What else could you look at to determine whether it was a voluntary consent? In the confines of the room, the smallness of the room, the three officers present, anything else?
And the statement that Jason claims the officer made about coming back and searching the whole house.
Was the bedroom door open immediately before the officers went in with the defendant?
To my knowledge, the bedroom door was closed when the officers entered the basement area.
You mean coming in the doors to the outside, that it was not open? Or do you mean the door into the bedroom?
The door to the bedroom was not open.
Counsel, ordinarily, if I don't want someone to follow me into a room, I just say to the person, please wait for me at the door. Your client didn't do that.
My client is a 24-year-old man, and you are the Justice of the Supreme Court. I think there's a big difference.
Only about 40 years.
There's a power difference, if you're honest. There's a knowledge difference.
So
I think that we can't compare what you would have done to what somebody else would have done who is not in your position. But let me pose that a different manner. In the state of Wisconsin, you are the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and you are well known as the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But if you are in France or in England or in some other country, you are merely some woman. And are you accorded the same deference that you would be accorded in the state of Wisconsin? I think not. And I think that's why, to analogize it with what you would have done as to what my client would have done, is an improper way of looking
at it. You don't think most people do that, then? If somebody is behind them and they just say, please wait for me out here.
I don't think we can make that as a contrast. I really don't. I think that you've got a young kid, and you've got three officers, and they're good-sized officers, and I think that they can be very intimidating.
Doesn't your client say that not only did he not give consent, but he was removed from the room early on while the police officers searched the place? So is that
yes,
your client's
does.
Testimony?
And I think, Your Honor, if you will look back over cases and over experience, it is the general procedure when police are making a search to remove the individual whose premises are being searched from the area that is being searched. That's standard operating procedure of the police department, that you don't have the individual witnessing exactly where you're searching. So that is consistent with normal police practice, to remove the individual from the area of immediate search. I think, Your Honor, wanted me to get into the constitutional question. Is that correct?
Yes.
The judge indicated that the violation was not so blatant. I think when you start out with a constitutional violation, it is a constitutional violation. Yes, there are some which are more heinous than others, but they are still constitutional violations. If one commits an act of first-degree sexual assault involving a child, it can be extremely egregious or it can be very minor, but it is still a first-degree sexual assault, and it is still subjective to the maximum range of penalties. And I think in this regard, what you have here is you have a violation which is acknowledged, and that violation which is acknowledged has to make you then look at what the overall effect of that violation was. And the overall effect of that violation was that the police got themselves into a position where they could exploit that entry to conduct a search. And the evidence, based on Investigator Londe's statements and the statements of Investigator Zablusky, was that they did exploit that entry. Londe says they exploited it by immediately he entered and was told he had permission to go and search. Londe, Zablusky says that I had permission to search. He claims he had permission to search because he says that Jason turned and entered the bedroom. And he assumed that by Jason entering the bedroom, that was it. But he doesn't say Jason entered the bedroom and held the door open. He says Jason entered the bedroom and we followed him in.
What else were they to assume?
Well, the way he states it, we don't know whether there was an opportunity for Jason to enter the bedroom and shut the door, or Jason was entering the bedroom and had any opportunity to shut the door or didn't want to shut the door.
Are there any facts in the record that leads to those conclusions?
Yes, I think the facts that enter into the record is the conflict between Zablusky's statement that it was after Jason turned and entered the bedroom that they followed him in, and Londe's statement that while Jason was talking to Zablusky, he and Simon were searching the area.
Do you think your client, under those circumstances, would be required to say, "Don't come in"? Does it have to be that direct, that strong?
No, sir, I don't. There was a question here about attenuation. If you look at the record, I did not argue that this was a case of attenuation. I didn't believe that attenuation entered into it because I believe that the officers went in and, based on Londe's statement, immediately began to search because of the fact that one of the officers stated that the search began contemporaneous with the entry. I don't see where attenuation fits in. So why they went into the area of attenuation.
I understand the argument. The state concedes that the initial entry into the home was illegal. But the state says the entry into the bedroom was as a result of a voluntary consent, and therefore that entry, a second entry, if you wish, was valid. The question then becomes, if I understand the state's position, and Mr. Lundson will correct me, you have an illegal entry, an illegal search, followed by a legal one, and the question then is there taint on the second legal search resulting from the initial illegality? And unless you can have an attenuation, unless you can show that the second is not affected by the first, then you have to knock out the second even though it's legal because it has been tainted. This is the fruit of the poison tree argument.
And I guess, Your Honor, my feeling is this: when you have an officer who makes a sworn statement to the effect that I entered and I and another officer immediately began to search, you don't have anything intervening to give you an argument for attenuation. And if there's any other questions that anybody has of me, I'll be glad to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nathan.
Thank you.
Mr. Mr. Lunston.
I don't know exactly how to tactfully address the topic of the facts. Mr. Nathan is misrepresenting the record. A lot of things that he's been saying about what the officers say is not true. For example, when he says that Officer Laundrie testified that they just entered the basement and then proceeded into the bedroom with no consent, isn't true. I invite you to read Officer Laundrie's testimony. I agree that he didn't really address what occurred inside the basement room, but that's the issue. He didn't really address, he didn't describe the sequence of events. But, and again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on Officer Sabluski gave conflicting testimony on this point. Mr. Nathan said that he never said that Mr. Phillips gave consent. That's not true. His primary testimony was that Mr. Phillips gave verbal consent. He then, later on, said something that sounded inconsistent. It made it sound like all Mr. Phillips did was give nonverbal consent, that he responded by opening the door. Unfortunately, the questioners at the trial level didn't pursue that inconsistency. I suspect the officer would have said, well, earlier he gave the verbal consent, but at the very time he opened the door, I had asked, you know, to go into the door, and he just opened the door. There might have been a way to reconcile that. We'll never know.
But there was a finding by the trial court that there was consent.
That there was consent.
Verbal consent.
No, the trial court didn't specify whether it was verbal or consent.
So, and there is sufficient, you will argue, there's sufficient credible evidence to support that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
so,
even a stronger argument than you have to make.
I'll go beyond the facts now, but I urge you to look at the record.
Well, Mr. Lunston, if I can characterize your argument, at least so far I hear you saying, getting away from the fact, not talking about whether there's sufficient attenuating circumstances, are you saying that the fact of verbal consent was in and of itself a sufficient attenuating circumstance so as to allow this evidence in?
No, but I like that question because there was, and I apologize for giving this to the court late, just last night I followed up on a lead of one of my counterparts at my office, and it led me to a Seventh Circuit decision that addresses that very point. Does voluntariness of consent all by itself constitute an attenuating factor? And the majority seemed to say yes. A concurring judge said, I disagree. I think it's a real significant factor. He called it a voluntary consent is a powerful intervening factor, but he declined to say that that was the end all. I agree with the concurrence.
Could you give us a cite for that?
Yes. It's United States v. Liss. LISS 103 F3rd 617, Seventh Circuit, it's a 1997 case.
So what else makes up?
Pardon me?
What besides the voluntariness then constitutes sufficient attenuating circumstances?
Let's just go back. You agree with the concurrence that it's not the.
I'm sorry.
Oh, you agree, you said with the concurrence that it's not the only factor, but. That's
so,
not the determinative factor, but it is.
Right. So I'm not
a negative factor.
Okay. Yes.
Now, I
perceive that to be his question. I don't think that's the end all of the. I don't think that's the end of it. Yeah, I think you have to look at the voluntary consent in context, and in the context of this case, when you compare it with other attenuation cases, the initial illegality. In terms of its coercive nature, in terms of how the police exploited what they had. I mean, there are attenuation cases where the police conduct illegal search, see contraband, use that knowledge of what they saw in their illegal search to then go and ask for consent. And then they get voluntary consent, and some courts will say that they didn't exploit that initial illegality to ultimately get the evidence. I think that's a much tougher argument. I'm glad I don't have to make that one. What I'm saying is that the nature of this illegal entry wasn't the type that, the police didn't exploit it. As I was saying earlier, the police really didn't gain anything by passing through that doorway. They could have accomplished the same thing if they had just stopped at the doorway, had the same conversation with Mr. Phillips. And I think that's a common sense look at the facts in this case.
Which doorway?
The open doorway that leads from the stairwell into the basement.
At that time, they could have asked him.
Because exactly, same conversation.
That's a question.
Both your arguments and your brief, as well as the testimony, would indicate to me that the police considered this, from the inception, a very minor, garden variety, little possession of marijuana case.
Apparently.
In fact, I think it's right in the transcript where he says we were looking for minor amounts of marijuana.
Yes.
And in fact, it's later proven that because they sent him a subpoena by mail or something.
Right, they never arrested him.
But on the other hand, it bothers me somewhat that, you know, that we might be, it almost sounds like you're saying, well, we can relax some standards here because of the minor nature of this. Are you saying that?
Well, I'm not, and, you know, and jurisprudence might have developed differently. You know, the courts might have developed a rule that says when the police do something illegal, and if that leads to, in the sequence of events, if that leads to the discovery of evidence, that we're going to punish the police by excluding that evidence. You could have a much broader rule, but that isn't how laws develop. I urge you to criticize the police in this case. You should. I just don't think that it should result in the suppression of this evidence, because when you look at the proper legal analysis, they didn't exploit the illegality to get that evidence.
Well, a couple of things. One, this is not punishing the police. What this is doing, if you on illegal searches, is protect all the rest of us from invasions.
Well, I think that's why they punish the police, so that the police will not violate our rights. So, again, it's a balancing act. You could punish the police every time, punish them by, you know, deep-sixing their prosecution, deep-sixing their case every time they do something illegal. But that isn't the way this court itself has done it in the past.
Well, your position is, regardless of whether this is a felony drug charge or misdemeanor drug charge, your position is that the police's conduct wasn't outrageous, as I hear it, and therefore, since it was rather a mild, they didn't go in with guns blasting, they didn't knock down doors, they didn't push him aside, that kind of thing. And that since this was a sort of an innocuous illegal entry, that it's attenuated.
Maybe this is a really important point to distinguish my position. I think that this is a blatant illegality. It was blatant, and as a Fourth Amendment violation, you know, the police should have known better. No excuse whatsoever, no justification. They deserve criticism for this.
And this is a home.
So if you just look at it as what kind of violation was it, it was a clear and blatant violation. When you look at attenuation analysis, I think the question isn't exactly latency in that way. It's the fundamental attenuation question is whether they exploited what they did to obtain the evidence. So I think the blatancy, I mean, the way
why was
they,
it not an exploitation?
Pardon me?
What are your arguments saying that it was not exploitation of the illegality?
In the context of the consent issue, I'm asking you to look at what happened physically, that from Mr. Phillips' perspective, it's not much different than if they had stopped at the doorway, so that what their illegal act didn't create a coercive environment, didn't significantly add to any coercive effect of their encounter. And in the so that's looking at it in terms of voluntarism and consent. And in terms of, and my other argument is that they didn't exploit it because they didn't enter, as I said earlier, they didn't enter to illegally seize evidence, to seize evidence without consent. They didn't enter to illegally search without consent. They just wanted to talk to Mr. Phillips, something they could have accomplished by just stopping at the open doorwell, open doorway, so that the police didn't exploit passing a few feet through that open doorway to obtain consent, which led them to the evidence. So, I'm real concerned that I'm not being as clear as I should be.
You seem to be saying they didn't exploit because they didn't exploit. I'm looking for a sentence that follows. They didn't exploit because. He said that they could ask for permission in the same manner outside of the outside door.
I'm sorry?
That they could have asked for permission of the defendant while they were still on the outside of the door.
Yeah, I'll give it one more shot if you want to give me the time. But I think I would repeat myself. The notion is that they could have achieved, this all would have happened just the same way if they had simply stopped at the doorway and talked to him through the open doorway. They didn't gain anything.
What would they have said at the open doorway?
What would they have said? They would have said the same words that they said inside the basement. They
Which
said,
were?
What's your name? We're here because we hear you're dealing in drugs. We think you've got the drugs. And we'd like the permission to search your bedroom because we're told that's where they are. And I think Mr. Phillips, if he was standing and talking to them through the doorway, or whether he was standing and talking to them inside the basement, would respond the same way.
And would raise it, the same issue of whether a consent given under those circumstances is voluntary. That's your point.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawson. Thank you, Mr. Nathan. That's the end of this case for the moment. And I'll call the next case.